Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for February 17th, 2023. We are broadcasting this week from the Take No Prisoners Department here at the Georgia Historical Society on the 15th floor of the Jepson House, overlooking beautiful Forsyth Park in downtown Savannah. So this week, I'm talking about the top Nazis and what happened to them after World War II. Now, you know, if you have been reading my blogs, and I know that you have, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a review of Volker Ulrich's biography of Adolf Hitler, the second volume. The first volume was reviewed right here on this podcast, the very first podcast I ever did back on August 25th, 2017, 5.5 years ago. And I wrote about the second volume recently. It is a brilliant biography. Ulrich is a German, and he wrote a biography that is in every way a wonderful successor to the great biographies of Hitler that were written by Ian Kershaw about 20 years ago, the British historian, written by Alan Bullock in 1952 and revised in 62 by Joachim Fest in 1973. It is a first-rate biography, and if you want to understand how the Nazis came to power and held on to it, I highly recommend it to you. So after I got through with that book, still fascinated with the Nazis and really their end, I decided to read two other books. One of them by Volker Ulrich, published in 2020. It's the most recent book he's written. It's a shorter book, only about 300 pages, called 8 Days in May, The Final Collapse of the Third Reich, published by Live Right in 2020. And another older book, but again, first rate, written by Joachim Fest, who, as I mentioned, wrote a biography of Hitler. It's called Inside Hitler's Bunker, The Last Days of the Third Reich. And there's a reason that I find all of this fascinating, which I'll sort of get to at the end. It's the absence of any physical remains of the Nazi regime, and yet we still know so much about the Nazis. You know the story of what happened. In addition to the writing a blog about the Hitler volume, I recorded a dispatch off the Deaton Path on May 1st, 2020, just as the pandemic was starting really good, recorded a video about the last days of the Third Reich in late April and early May 1945, 75 years earlier. And there I talked about what happened to Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. Of course, they both killed themselves. Hitler and some of the top Nazis had squirreled themselves away in the Hitler bunker 50 feet underground in Berlin. And as the Soviets closed in on Berlin, rather than be taken prisoner, rather than be taken back to Moscow for some sort of a trial or execution, or to meet a similar fate as Mussolini, who you will recall was captured by Italian partisans on April 28th, and his body, he was executed, and his body was horribly mutilated and displayed in public for the public to take out some of their vengeance on their fallen leader. And Hitler learned about this, and he determined he was not going to go out like that. So on the afternoon of April 30th, he and his newlywed bride, Eva Braun, killed themselves by taking cyanide capsules, and then Hitler shot himself in the temple. Their bodies were taken upstairs into the Reich Chancellery Garden, where they were burned beyond recognition. And whatever was left of them was taken and buried in a very shallow grave. Now, Joseph Goebbels, who was the Nazi minister of propaganda, he and his wife also determined they were not going to leave Berlin. They were not going to try to break out and escape, but they were also not going to be taken prisoner. They could not live in a world without Hitler and the Third Reich. So they killed their 6 children there in the bunker by giving them morphine, which put them to sleep, and then they gave them cyanide tablets to kill them, and then they killed themselves. They shot themselves in the head, took cyanide tablets. Their bodies were only partially burned. And the Soviets, when they finally took the bunker, managed to capture the bodies of Goebbels and his wife. They dug up what was left of Hitler and Eva Braun, and also took the bodies of the 6 Goebbels children, and they buried them. And they buried them and reburied them several times over the next year, and they finally wound up at a Soviet military camp in Magdeburg, Germany. If you fast forward 25 years, I told this story that the Soviets got ready to hand over this military installation to the East German government, and they didn't want the graves of Hitler, and Goebbels et al. To become shrines for neo-Nazis. And so the head of the KGB at that time was Yuri Andropov. He later became Soviet premier in the 1980s, but he ordered that the remains be exhumed, that they be cremated, they be crushed into dust and thrown into the Elbe River. And that happened in April 1970, 45 or 25 years after the end of the war. So, what happened to the other top Nazis? Now, it's laid out in both of these books, and it's a fascinating story. Many of them escaped justice. These, again, are some of the most heinous crimes in history. And to a person, they all said they were following orders or didn't know what was happening. Some of them did. Some of them knew what was happening and certainly continued to be strident Nazis. But most of them, the top echelon of the Nazis after Hitler and Goebbels would have included Hermann Goering, who, of course, at one time was the number two, destined to succeed Hitler. Also, Martin Bormann, and, of course, Heinrich Himmler, who was head of the SS, one of the top architects of the Holocaust. Their fates were a little bit different. Goering was actually captured. He was captured by the Allies, and he, along with others, were put on trial in Nuremberg. We'll talk about what happened with Bormann and Himmler. So in mid-1945, when the war is over, France, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and of course the United States agreed to convene a joint tribunal in Nuremberg with the Nuremberg Charter, which they had all adopted as the legal instrument. Their creation, the International Military Tribunal, tried 21 of the most important surviving leaders of Nazi Germany. Between November 20th, 1945 and October 1st, 1946, they held trials. And these leaders came from the political, military, and economic spheres, as well as six German organizations like the SS, like the Gestapo. And the purpose was not just to convict these defendants, but also to assemble irrefutable evidence of Nazi crimes, because they amassed all of this evidence and offer a history, not only a history lesson, not only to the defeated Germans, but to the entire world, and to delegitimize the traditional German elite. So the indictment that they created lodged against these Nazis contained four counts. The first was crimes against peace, that is, planning, initiating, waging wars of aggression in violation of international treaties and agreements. Two, crimes against humanity, that is, the exterminations, deportations, and genocide that were carried out by the Nazis. Third, war crimes, violation of the laws of war. And four, common plan or conspiracy to commit the criminal acts that were listed in the first three counts. As I mentioned, two of the most prominent Nazis, Hitler and Goebbels, and Heinrich Himmler, had all committed suicide and therefore and could not be tried and were not tried. The prosecutors wanted to try representative leaders of German politics, economy, and the military, and the Americans had a list of 70 names that they originally wanted tried. Most of the defendants, by the way, had surrendered to the United States or the United Kingdom. They were not going to surrender to the Soviets, who they thought would either shoot them on sight or take them back to Moscow for show trials and then execute them. Now, the defendants were largely unrepentant. There were former cabinet ministers like Franz von Papen, who had brought Hitler to power, Joachim von Ribbentrop, the foreign minister, Interior Minister Wilhelm Frick, Alfred Rosenberg, minister for the occupied Eastern Territories. There were leaders of the German economy there, Gustav Krupp, who came from the conglomerate Krupp Group, former Reichsbank president Hjalmar Schacht, economic planners Albert Speer and Walter Funk, along with Speer's subordinate and head of the forced labor program, Fritz Sauckel. Military leaders there, Hermann Goering, as I mentioned, Wilhelm Keitel, Alfred Jodl, Erich Rieder, and Karl Donitz, as well as propagandist Julius Streicher, who was the publisher of Der Stürmer, The Storm, and Hans Fritsch. Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy who had flown to Britain in a so-called peace mission in 1941. That's a fascinating story if you don't know it. Hans Frank, who was governor general of the General Governorate of Poland. Hitler youth leader, Baldur von Schirach. Arthur Sess Inquart, who was the Reich Commissar for the Netherlands, and Ernst Kaltenbrunner, who was the scarred-faced leader of Himmler's Reich Main Security Office. These were the top people. And on October 1st, 1946, the verdict on 22 of the original 24 defendants was handed down. Now, Robert Ley, who was the head of the German Labor Front, committed suicide while he was in prison. He hung himself with a towel in the lavatory. And Gustav Krupp, you mentioned, I remember I mentioned him, his mental and physical condition had deteriorated to the point they decided he could not be tried. So of the 22 who were tried, three were acquitted completely. Schacht, von Papen, and Hans Fritsch. Four of the 22 were sentenced to terms of imprisonment ranging anywhere from 10 to 20 years. Karl Dönitz, von Schirach, Albert Speer, who later became known as the good Nazi because he claimed that, you know, he didn't know anything, and when he did, he lamented that he didn't go and tell Hitler. It was all complete nonsense, according to Volker Ulrich. Speer was as bad as anybody, and Konstantin von Neurath. Now, three were sentenced to life imprisonment: Rudolf Hess, Walter Funk, and Erich Rieder. 12 of the defendants were sentenced to death by hanging, and 10 of them were hanged. On October 16th, 1946, one after the other, Hans Frank, Wilhelm Frick, Julius Streicher, Alfred Rosenberg, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, Joachim von Ribbentrop, Sauckel, Jodl, Keitel, and Sess Inquart. They were all hanged. Hermann Göring, who was sentenced to be hanged and was actually scheduled to be the very first one executed, he committed suicide 2 hours before he was supposed to be executed. Somehow, he bribed a guard who allowed a cyanide capsule to be smuggled into his prison cell, and he cheated the hangman, as they say. Now, Martin Bormann was tried and condemned to death in absentia. He wasn't there, and they didn't know where he was. More on him in just a minute. Now, of the three sentenced to life in prison, what happened to them? Well, Walter Funk, the Reich Minister for Economic Affairs, was released in 1957 because of poor health. He died of diabetes 3 years later, May 31st, 1960, at the age of 69. Grand Admiral Erich Rieder was also released early on September 26th, 1955, because of poor health. He died 5 years later, November 6th, 1960, at the age of 84. Now, only Rudolf Hess, the Deputy Fuhrer, who had left Germany and flown to Scotland in 1941 on a so-called peace mission, served out his entire life term, and even then, he did not die of natural causes. He died in Spandau Prison in Berlin, August 17, 1987, 42 years after the end of the war, at the age of 93. He managed to kill himself. He had been the only prisoner there in Spandau for 21 years. This prison was built to house 600 people. He was the only one in it. Since Albert Speer's release in 1966, the Soviet Union had blocked repeated attempts by his family members, prominent politicians, people who simply said, you know, because of his age, that he needed to be released. Still in custody, the only prisoner in Spandau, although with a lot of leeway. He didn't sit in a cell all day. He hanged himself at the age of 93. Now, a lot of people said he couldn't have hanged himself. He must have been murdered. The Allies murdered him. He didn't have the strength as an old man to do that, but later evidence showed that he did. After his death, the prison, Spandau Prison, was demolished to prevent it, too, from becoming a neo-Nazi shrine. And by the way, Hess remained unapologetic, anti-Semitic, a loyal Nazi, and unrepentant till the very end. He was initially buried at a secret location to avoid media attention or demonstrations by Nazi sympathizers, but his body was reinterred in a family plot in Wunsiedel, and pardon my French pronunciation, I'm sure I'm butchering this, March 17th, 1988. His wife buried beside him in 1995. Now, sure enough, his grave became a destination for neo-Nazi pilgrimage and for demonstrations every August on the anniversary of his death. The parish council decided not to allow an extension on the grave's lease when it expired in 2011. With the eventual consent of his family, his grave was reopened on July 20 of that year. His remains were cremated, the ashes scattered at sea by family members. So, again, a top Nazi, not buried, has no grave. The grave and his body, you know, cremated, burned to ashes, and scattered to the winds. His gravestone, which bore the epitaph, and I won't even try to do it in German, meant it said, "I have dared," was destroyed as well. And as I mentioned, Spandau Prison, demolished in 1987 to prevent it from becoming a neo-Nazi shrine. All the bodies of the 10 Nazis executed at Nuremberg were cremated, their ashes scattered in the river Isar. So all of these top Nazis, from Hitler to Goebbels to Goering to all of these other ones to Rudolf Hess, their bodies cremated, scattered to the four winds, pulverized into dust so that nothing was left and there's no physical remains buried in the ground anywhere. Now, I mentioned Martin Bormann, who was tried in absentia at Nuremberg. He was thought to have escaped for many years. He got to South America. They didn't know what happened to him. After Hitler committed suicide, Bormann and others attempted to flee Berlin on May 2nd to avoid capture by the Soviets. Bormann committed suicide on a bridge in Berlin as the Soviets closed in. This was found out later. His body was buried nearby on May 8th, 1945, but wasn't found and confirmed as his until 1973. The identification was reaffirmed by 1998, over 50 years after the end of the war, by DNA tests. As I mentioned, he was tried in absentia by the International Military Tribunal at the Nuremberg trials in 1945 and 46. He was convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity and sentenced to death by hanging. So he would have met the same fate. Now, here's what happened. So in 1963, a retired postal worker came forward and told West German police that around May 8th, 1945, the Soviets had ordered him and his colleagues to bury two bodies found near a railway bridge. One was dressed in a Wehrmacht uniform, and the other was clad only in his underwear. Excavations in July of 1965, 2 years later, at the site specified, failed to locate the bodies. Fast forward 7 years, December 7th, 1972, construction workers uncovered human remains in West Berlin, just 39 feet from the spot where the postal worker claimed he had buried these bodies. The autopsy revealed fragments of glass found in the jaws of both skeletons, suggesting that these men, like all the other Nazis, had committed suicide by biting cyanide capsules to avoid capture. Dental records identified one of these skeletons as Martin Bormann's. Damage to the collarbone of the skeleton was consistent with injuries that Bormann's sons reported he had sustained in a riding accident in 1939. Forensic examiners determined the size of the skeleton and the shape of the skull were identical to Bormann's. The West German government at that point declared him dead, but the family was not permitted to cremate these remains in case further forensic examination later proved necessary. And 25 years later, the remains were conclusively identified as Martin Bormann's in 1998 when German authorities ordered genetic testing on fragments of the skull. Tests using DNA from one of the Bormann relatives identified the skull as that of Martin Bormann. And at that point, Bormann's remains were cremated and his ashes were scattered over the Baltic Sea on August 16, 1999, 54 years after the end of the war. Now, famously, the story of Adolf Eichmann is one of the most fascinating. He was one of the top SS leaders and architects of the Holocaust. He did, in fact, escape to Argentina. And he was finally tracked down by Israeli agents, and Argentina was notorious for not wanting to extradite Nazis, former war criminals, out. So he was captured, I'm putting air quotes around that, by Israeli agents on May 11, 1960, and brought to Israel for trial, where, on December 15, 1961, he was found guilty of crimes against humanity and was sentenced to death by hanging. He was executed, that is, Adolf Eichmann, executed in Israel on June 1, 1962. Within hours of his body, his body had been cremated and his ashes scattered in the Mediterranean Sea outside Israeli territorial waters by an Israeli Navy boat. That leaves one last top Nazi we haven't talked about, Heinrich Himmler. Now, Himmler was one of the worst of the worst. He was one of the prime architects of the Holocaust, the head of the SS. He tried to escape and go into hiding. He and a small band of companions headed south out of Berlin on foot, hoping to just melt into the chaos with all of the soldiers in Berlin who were surrendering at that point. On May 11th, 3 days after Germany's unconditional surrender, he headed south. 10 days later, on May 21st, Himmler and two aides were stopped and detained at a checkpoint set up by former Soviet POWs. Over the following 2 days, he was moved around to several camps and was finally brought to a British civilian interrogation camp near Lunenburg on May 23rd. The officials noticed that Himmler's identity papers bore a stamp which British military intelligence had seen being used by fleeing members of the SS. So that raised their suspicions. They still didn't know who he was. But during a routine interrogation, Himmler, maybe because he just couldn't, he wanted to boast, we don't know, admitted who he was, and he was searched. He was taken to the headquarters of the 2nd British Army there in Lunenburg, where a doctor conducted a medical exam. And while trying to open his mouth, the doctor attempted to examine the inside of his mouth. Himmler jerked his head away and bit into a hidden potassium cyanide pill, collapsed onto the floor, and was dead within 15 minutes, despite efforts that they made there to expel the poison from his system. So shortly afterward, 4 soldiers were given the task, taking his body out, drove it down the road, buried it in an unmarked grave on the side of the road in Lunenburg, near there, and covered it up, unmarked. And that grave location remains unknown and presumably is still there, making Heinrich Himmler the only top Nazi whose body lies undisturbed in a grave somewhere in Germany. Now, other subsequent trials found other lesser Nazis, and I use that word with quotes around it, guilty, particularly the Einsatzgruppen and the death squads who went into Eastern Europe. But by the early 1950s, the British, the French, and the Americans were more interested in fighting the Soviets in the Cold War than in prosecuting and executing Nazis from the last war. Many who had, in fact, been sentenced to death had their sentences commuted, and they were released from jail by the early 1950s. If you've ever seen the 1961 film Judgment at Nuremberg, you know that one of the running themes throughout that movie is the tension that had built up even by the late 1940s when this film was supposedly taking place between the needs of the Americans for German cooperation in the Cold War against the Soviets and the need to bring Nazis to justice. And the whole thing plays out with that backdrop. If you haven't seen Judgment at Nuremberg, I highly recommend that you watch it. It's a brilliant film directed by Stanley Kramer, starring an all-star cast, headlined by Spencer Tracy as one of the American judges. Maximilian Schell played the attorney who defended the Nazis. He won an Academy Award for Best Actor for his performance in that film. Now, you probably know, if you go to Germany today as a historical tourist, you know you can't visit sites associated with the Nazis because, as I mentioned, most of them have, if not all of them, have been destroyed. They don't want any of these places to be shrines for neo-Nazis. So, for instance, the Hitler bunker was destroyed. Now, according to the internet, there are parts of a few corridors of the bunker that still remain there, but they're not open to the public. You cannot go there. The graves of the top Nazis, as we know, are not there. Now, it's very interesting to me that we know so much about the Nazis, and we do, right? There are so many books, countless books, and documentaries, and films that have come out about the Nazis and continue coming out. We know all this without their physical remains, or monuments, or statues, or buildings, or graves. Yes, there are places like concentration camps that the Nazis built that have, of course, been maintained as memorials to victims of the Holocaust. But when in this country, when we discuss monuments and statues and what to do with them, we often talk about, you hear this, if you take monuments and statues down, you're erasing history. And I'm not advocating that we take them down. I'm just repeating what is so often given as a reason that they have to be left up. But isn't it amazing that we know so much about the Nazis without any of the physical remains of the regime? It underscores the point. You don't need monuments or statues, most of which come much later, or even buildings or graves in order to learn about the past, as long as you can consult the documentary and archival evidence of which so much exists relating to the Nazis. Steven Spielberg made this point very well in Schindler's List. You will recall every time a railroad train pulled up somewhere and the Nazis were offloading people for their camps, there was someone sitting there with a typewriter who recorded their name, making the point that this was a well-documented mass murder genocide. The history of the top Nazis remains despite their complete and utter physical destruction. The evil that they did remains even as their physical presence has been utterly obliterated and turned to dust. Check out both of these books that I mentioned. Inside Hitler's Bunker, The Last Days of the Third Reich by Joachim Fest, and 8 Days in May, The Final Collapse of the Third Reich by Volker Ulrich, and Ulrich's biographies of Hitler. I think you will learn a lot from them. You will enjoy reading them if you like learning about World War II and are still trying to come to grips with, as we all are, with how one of the most evil regimes in history ever came to power and maintained that power. And the men who carried out some of the most heinous crimes under authority of government and how they met their end. The hardest working producer and engineer in show business, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS unicycle polo team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Krellen. Our director of the GHS one-man damn Yankees fan club is Keith Pinstripes Stragero. Our GHS coordinator of classroom indoctrination is Lisa War Eagle Landers. The GHS Empress of the Historical Marker, don't call them monuments division, is Elise 135 Words Butler. The director of the GHS ZZ Top Beard Division is our very own Nate Sharp Dress Man Peterson. Our Off the Eaten Path fact checker is Ella Fino. Our director of employee loyalty is Upton Leftus. The Off the Eaten Path holiday wardrobe consultant is Don Wienow. Our staff layoff specialist is Harry Verderci, assisted by layoff counselor Oscar LaVista. The chairman of our underemployment studies group is Art Majors. Our staff director of Three Stooges Studies is Lee Iapoca. Dr. Todd Gross's personal eBay specialist is Selma Junkoff, and our off-the-beaten path martini mixer is Olive Twist. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone and on Spotify. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Deaton Path on Facebook as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, my blog, and similar Crimes Against Humanity podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening.